one of my favourite definitions of a diplomat is of a man who thinks twice before saying nothing. Happily, I'm no longer a diplomat, so I rather hope to say something substantial to you in the course of this afternoon. But I chose my title, Russia, A New Whiff of Optimism, back in July. And on reflection, I should have been a little bit more cautious. It should have been Russia, maybe a new whiff of less pessimism. Unless, of course, you accept the Russian definition of an optimist, who is a man who thinks that tomorrow will be better than the day after tomorrow. Anyway, what I'm going to do is go back to the last time we were all feeling positive about Russia, which was quite a long time ago, in August 1991 or just after, and come from there up to the present day by way of painting a picture of where we now are and exploring a little bit where we may go from here. You all, of course, remember August 1991. Communism fell. There was the coup in Moscow itself. The Soviet Union fell apart. And we all looked forward to a new democratic free market Russia emerging from the fragments in exactly the same way as all our new democratic free market Eastern European friends and now EU members did out of the former Soviet Empire. And it didn't happen. And it's worth asking why it didn't happen in the case of Russia, particularly vis-a-vis the East Europeans. And there are a whole range of rather obvious reasons. The central one, or a central one, was a hugely botched economic reform, which, first of all, led essentially to the breakdown of the Russian economy, an economy which had been built on people trading according to the plan, had a lot of trouble to people trading according to money and demand. In the course of transferring most of the Russian economy into private hands, an awful lot of that economy found itself in very few hands. So there was also, at the same time, huge social stratification in Russia and huge resentment by the vast majority of the Russian people who found themselves, having previously been moderately well-off citizens of a proud, upstanding superpower, suddenly deeply impoverished, with the oligarchs, upper class, whom they on the whole hated and still hate, deeply insecure about their jobs, about their income, all of that, and deeply resentful of their country's much shrunken place in the world. And this poisoned the initial phase of Russian democratic politics. What you had was President Yeltsin saying to the people, to the provinces, to everyone, take as much power as you can handle. Let's get away from the old monopoly of power in the Kremlin. Let's get into a much more pluralistic politics. But the reaction at all levels was we will take power to benefit ourselves personally, economically. There was none of the underlying understandings upon which real democracy depends. There was a huge tendency towards, well, nostalgic politics, if I can put it that way, towards bringing back communism. It was only by really quite dark manipulation that Yeltsin succeeded in winning the 1996 presidential election against the biggest competitor whom he was facing, which was the Communist Party. There was also a very sharp upsurge in a rather nasty nationalism, exemplified by Zhirinovsky, anti-Semitic, revanchist in the worst possible way. So democratic politics, for a variety of rather obvious reasons in retrospect, simply didn't work at that stage. And on top of all that, there was international humiliation. The balancing factor is the wrong way to put it, but the other half of the Cold War having suddenly collapsed, the West moved into space and moved with self-confidence on various international issues, which was deeply, deeply uncomfortable for the Russians. Our war in Kosovo, fought without Security Council authority, was done in the teeth of massive Russian objections. The expansion of NATO steadily eastwards to take in, first of all, East Germany, then the Eastern European states, and then indeed former bits of the Soviet Union, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, was very, very threatening in Russian eyes, particularly since they claimed that they had assurances at the time that they were pulling out of Eastern Europe that we weren't going to do it. And in addition to all that, the Russians felt that their country was falling apart. They had a very nasty war, series of wars going on in Chechnya about independence for there. Tatarstan felt as if it was edging away from the rest of the Union, geographically impossible though that is. Sakha, out in the depths of eastern Siberia, also was looking for more and more autonomy. So everything was going wrong. National cohesion, internal politics, international standing, money, all of that. And the Russians, in this situation, went back to what may be a sort of ancestral instinct. They looked around for and found a strong man to begin to pull the place together again. The strong man was, of course, Vladimir Putin. You can have arguments about how he got the job of president at the beginning of the year 2000. But having watched a bit of the process, both here and in Moscow, I am pretty clear that Yeltsin, in his mind, as he picked Putin, was looking for someone who had the FSB experience, had the security experience, had the toughness to begin to remedy some of the things which he, Yeltsin, appreciated had gone wrong under his own rule. Putin arrives and in really quite short order begins to pull the place together. And what pulling the place together was about power. It was about taking control over the various forces which were acting in vociferous ways on Russia at the time. So he dealt with Chechnya, unpleasantly, brutally, but Chechnya, there are problems there, but Chechnya is now no longer a threat to the integrity of the Russian Federation. He dealt with the threats, the damage that democracy in the widest sense was doing. He brought the key thing to bring under control for this purpose was the press, and in particular Russian language television, which is the sole nationwide glue which drives the political process, and by getting rid of a couple of oligarchs who had troublesome TV shows, notably Berezovsky, who lives here now, and Gusinski, who lives in Israel now, he took very firm control of the press and therefore, in effect, of the political process. He dealt with the regional barons. One of the legacies of Yeltsin were very powerful figures, notably out east, but not only there, in Tatarstan, I've mentioned. We've just seen the last of them go from Moscow itself. But he changed the law so that they were no longer directly elected by their regional electorates, but they were chosen by him. And astonishingly, they therefore became much more cooperative with the central authorities than they had been before. He dealt with the oligarchs. The oligarchs were the other great source of countervailing power in Russia. Very rich, very powerful. As I've said, Berezovsky was sent off. Gusinski was sent off. The real demonstration event for oligarchs was, in fact, Khodorkovsky. At the time, at about the time actually that I arrived in Russia as ambassador, Russia's richest man, running Russia's largest and most successful oil company, Yukos, suddenly facing a series of tax evasion charges, a questionable legal process follows, and he is now serving 8 years in a Siberian jail, and moreover, even as we speak, is coming to the end of a further trial under which he's accused of stealing the money which he's previously was accused of not paying taxes on, and may well, I think the odds are, will face an extended further period in Siberia. Whereupon, of course, all the other oligarchs suddenly become much more attentive to what the Kremlin wants in their business behaviour. And he dealt, eventually, with relations with the West. He was very cautious here, but this did happen while I was ambassador. Suddenly, after putting up with a lot of what they saw as humiliation by the West, the worm sort of turned. They suspended their observance of a treaty which no one had ever heard of before, but this made an impact in the arms control community, the treaty on conventional forces in Europe. He gave a Munich speech which in effect said we're a proud nation and we're not going to knuckle under to the West anymore. They became very critical of various NATO and other activities. But the key moment where they most effectively blew a raspberry at the West was, of course, in 2008 in Georgia. And Georgia was a war which I had spent 4 years as ambassador predicting, so I'm slightly relieved that it took place while I was still there. You won't quote me on this, but the Georgians, in a sense, brought what happened on themselves. Nevertheless, the Russians seized the opportunity, which the Georgians gave them, to demonstrate that a small, pro-Western, troublesome countries wanting to join NATO had to take Russia's essential national interests into account. The question of Georgia joining NATO has now been put off sine die, and there's much more attention around Russia's borders to making sure that Russia's interests are taken into account as they frame their various policies towards it. So Putin took control of Russia, dealt with the various problems, and in particular, and I leave this last quite deliberately, turned the economy around. Now, partly the turning around of the economy was luck. He arrived more or less at the time that the oil price began to recover, and if there is a single parameter which drives Russia's economic health, it is the oil price. As the oil price recovered, so that fed into all of the big deficits which Russia had previously had, a huge external deficit, a huge government deficit. Those disappeared, and it became possible for Putin to deliver a rising standard of living for the Russian population, and that, of course, helped his popularity magnificently. The stronger feeling of order also helped. The feeling that there was a grip on the economy helped potential investors to take Russia seriously as an investment destination, helped companies thinking of expanding, consolidating, diversifying, also to do so in a much more stable environment. By no means a perfect environment. There are all sorts of things wrong with the Russian business environment, but it was, by comparison with the anarchy which had prevailed under Yeltsin, it was a much clearer environment within which to do business. And Putin therefore yielded for Russia 10 years of really quite fast economic growth from 2000 to 2008. And it was a very good thing, of course. Very popular, very successful, Russia feeling its oats, in the views of everybody, you know, doing rather well. One of the BRICS is how they think of themselves now. You remember the great Goldman Sachs group, Brazil, Russia, India, China. The Russians really rather proud of the fact that they're in that group, that they're seen as a leading emerging economy, and they attach a lot of value to being in that company. It was all going great until 2008, when we had the great banking crash and so on. And I was actually at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, which the president always comes along to speak at and others come along to speak at, in June 2008. And I heard Medvedev, who by then had become president, but I say this with Putin actually retaining his grip on most of the levers of power. I recall Medvedev saying at that forum, "We're sorry that the West has all its banking and other problems." That is plainly, and the German actually finance minister who was also there said exactly the same thing. "We're sorry the Anglo-Saxons have these problems. We sympathise with the economic difficulties they're going through, but of course it isn't going to affect us. We've got lots of oil, we're doing lots of trade around the world, why do we care?" And it did affect them. It was a very, very nasty shock for Russia, which of the four BRICS did much, much worse than any of the others. Their economy in 2009 actually shrunk by 8%, a huge contraction in economic strength. Two reasons for that. Firstly, oil prices, of course, fell quite substantially as a result of the recession. And secondly, Russia, unlike any of the other BRICS, has a completely open capital economy. The ruble is entirely convertible. There are no controls. And at the first hint of trouble, lots and lots of capital fled for safety. And Russia found itself obliged to spend $200 billion on keeping the ruble afloat until they got over that period of fear, with all of the knock-on effects that had for in internal economic activity. So, if I can leave you with one question to ask yourselves about Russia looking forward in the aftermath of that shock. I should say, the shock was bad. They're now beginning to emerge from it. Growth this year is going to be about 4%. Self-confidence is beginning to re-establish itself. The oil price is back up. If I can leave you with one question to ask yourself, looking at Russia going forward, it is, have they learnt anything from the recession? Because in the period of Putin's, you know, the high growth and all the money and all the success, they got overconfident. They stopped worrying about the views of international investors in their economy. They were actually quite nasty to a few international investors. You'll remember the sagas we had over TNK-BP and over Shell's Sakhalin project. They stopped reforming their economy. There is, as I say, an awful lot wrong with their economy. It's very corrupt. It's very bureaucratic. The measure is that buying assets in Russia, by comparison with buying assets in, say, Brazil or China, Russian assets are priced at about 25% less. And that reflects the costs of the lack of legal system, the the bureaucratic uncertainties, the corruption, the sheer difficulty of doing business there. So they got overconfident. Question, they had the shock. Question, have they learnt anything? Are they now going, as a result of the shock, to sort out those key underlying infrastructural and systemic problems which have held them back in the past? And half of the answer is that they are talking as if they have learnt the lessons. You will find Medvedev now and Putin now, the key word on both of their lips is modernisation. It is creating a high-tech, highly industrialised, modern economy, thus replacing the excessive dependence on oil, on natural resources, which they see as being part of the problem which led them into the major collapse in 2009. They have taken some rather hesitating and unproven steps to deal with the bureaucracy and the corruption and all that. They passed a couple of laws earlier this year, actually, which limit the number of certificates and bureaucratic approvals you need to start a new business and that sort of thing. Untested, we will see. They placed First Deputy Prime Minister Shuvalov, who's a very good guy, in charge of improving business conditions for international investors, making it a place that's safe for international companies to invest in. Medvedev has worked up a very good line in talking about the importance for Russia of dealing with what he calls legal nihilism, which means the absence of a dependable legal structure and court system there, of talking about the importance of dealing with corruption. One of the justifications which has been offered as they have removed Mayor Lushkov from Moscow in the course of the last few weeks is that he, Lushkov, ran a very corrupt regime, which of course he did, and this explains why they needed to change him. There's a lot more to it than that, and I wouldn't put down the removal of Lushkov actually to corruption there, since there's corruption in lots of other places as well, but the fact that they're talking about it is a sign that they recognise the seriousness of the problem. So they're certainly talking the talk of an administration which appreciates that they underperformed in the latter part of the first decade of the 21st century, that they appreciate the need to modernise, as they say, the economy, to make it much less one-dimensional, resource-based economy. Question is, do they mean it? Can they deliver? And on this, I have to say, opinions are very divided. And that there are good reasons to be doubtful. This whole modernisation thing, if you begin to unpick it, what it is about, what it looks like, what the concrete plans are that have emerged, they are plans for top-down, the state putting money into an outfit called Rosnanotech, which is this is $8 billion, designed to create a Russian nanotechnology industry. A high-tech concentration to a place called Skolkovo, where through tax incentives and others, the idea is to generate a technical hub, a technological hub, a high technological hub, like the one I live in, Cambridge, to inject that sort of dynamism into the Russian economy. All of which sounds very fine, except that it raises, one is automatically asks two questions. Anyone who knows anything about Russia instantly asks, well, why should it work this time if it didn't work under Gref 10 years ago, under Stalypin 100 years ago? Why these great top-down modernizations of Russia have never worked in the past? Why should it work now? And secondly, this doesn't feel proportionate to the scale of the problem. You don't deal with massive corruption, with massive bureaucracy, with a deep lack of legal certainty by creating a high-tech hub and a high-tech company. And, I mean, I'm still left faintly wondering, I have to say. I mean, these people are not stupid. They know very well that you don't deal with the depths of the problems by creating a Skolkovo and a Rosnanotech. And there are two possible explanations in my mind, and I offer them both to you. One is that this is simply political pabulum. They've had a rough time through the recession. They need to be seen to be doing something, so modernisation is it. The alternative, more encouraging explanation, is that the no doubt deep bureaucratic fights that have gone on about Skolkovo and have gone on about Rosnanotech are a preliminary to conducting those fights on a wider scale for more worthwhile outcomes. If you can get a sensible tax regime for Skolkovo, then why can't you get a sensible tax regime for the whole country? if you can get a sensible management export-import regime for Osnanotech, then why can't you get a sensible import-export regime for the whole country? And I like to think that these are more in the way of pilot projects for a much bigger reform project, which one hopes is coming down the line. But the real reason to doubt why all of this talk of modernisation might work is because the current system, first of all, the pressure to reform it radically has diminished. With the oil price back up again, the concerns, the deep economic concerns which hit them last year are dissipating. And secondly, an awful lot of people do very well, insiders do very well out of the current system and have no interest in a more transparent, more legally defined Russian economic system than they have got at the moment. And for me, the jury is out. There's an awful lot of pessimism about whether the reform push is going to work, but there are reasons for optimism which Russians being Russians... let me tell you a story, a joke I heard, which tells a little bit about Russia. Three people looking at a picture of the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve there, and an Englishman, a Swede, and a Russian. And the Swede says, well, they're obviously Swedish, you know, they're love children celebrating in the outside air. And the Englishman says, this is obviously England, look at that beautiful garden. And the Russian says, look at these two people. They can't afford clothes, they're obviously homeless, and they've only got one apple to eat. They're obviously Russian. And that tells you quite a lot about Russia's sort of gloomy self-presentation, which I think feeds quite a lot into the wider self-presentation. But there are, as I say, hidden reasons why my original title of optimism, I think, to some extent, holds true. Another recent event, which many people... Well, we all spotted the big forest fires, of course, in Russia, and we all spotted that they therefore put a limit on grain exports, and we all spotted that this had quite a dramatic effect on the world's grain markets. Prices went up by 5% or so. I invite you all to just think a little bit about that. Agriculture was the most catastrophic single bit of the old communist economy. When I first went to Russia in... I can't even remember the date, 1994, the one bit of the economy that we took no interest in at all was agriculture. It was broken down, the countryside was full of drunks living on kolkhozes doing as little as possible. In the course of the next 20 years, unnoticed by us, agriculture has to some extent consolidated, to some extent let outsiders in. While I was there as ambassador, I met these two wonderful Nottingham farmers who had somehow put together 20,000 hectares of land at the top of the Black Earth and were producing agricultural produce at six times the Russian average. And that revolution, unnoticed, gone on behind the backs of all of the people who are vying for oil profits and nickel profits and all of that, now makes Russia the third largest grain producer in the world. Similarly, on the corruption point, at about the time I arrived as ambassador, there was a big law passed which was going to close down all of the casinos in virtually all over Russia. Now, I don't know if many of you visited Moscow at the beginning of the 21st century. It had more casinos per head than anywhere except Macau and Las Vegas. It was an extraordinary, glitzy, corrupt, gambling capital. And of course, when they passed this law, we all said, that's not going to happen. Far too much money is going to go into people's pockets. It's going to be put off and off and off. I was back in Moscow a couple of months ago, and the casinos have closed. They've actually succeeded in moving them. They can do these things, even in the teeth of establishment interests, when they choose to. Let me finish with a bit of the Russian picture, which I think is of most interest to this particular audience, which is their external relations. Because as I said, back under late Putin as president, these were very prickly, culminating in the Georgia War. Since then, we've had the US reset, and hesitant as I am to become a spokesman for President Obama, I have to say that the reset looks as if it's worked. It's worked not only because the Americans have themselves become more attentive to Russian prickliness in the way they've conducted their foreign policy. There's also one other very big reason why Russia is having to pull itself together, and another very big reason why Russia is becoming more sensible internally and more emollient externally, which is China. People have not really focused enough on the effect of China on Russia. But if you imagine yourself as a Russian looking at your eastern end, you are looking at a very fast-growing neighbour. You're looking at a neighbour which, with which, although you have an agreed border, actually 350,000 miles of your territory has been denounced in the past by the Chinese as the product of an unequal treaty, which is a slightly implied Chinese statement to the moral right to take back, in particular, Vladivostok and Khabarovsk in the Far East. You have a nation which, well, let me just give an example. The Primorsky province, which is the province of Russia, which where Vladivostok is, has a population of about 2 million people. The province of Heilongjiang, if I pronounce that approximately right, which is the bit of China immediately on the other side of the Amur River from the Primorsky province, which is about the same size, has a population of 38 million people. The issue of population pressure and different economic dynamism, because Heilongjiang is an extremely dynamic part of China, Vladivostok, Khabarovsk, all of the Far East are very broken down parts of Russia. The fear that there's going to be a sort of swamping is very real in the Russian mind. So, various reasons, a more emollient West, there's no overt hostility, but a China which I suspect in the deep recesses of the Russian security establishment they're getting more and more worried about, combine to give us a Russia which I suspect is going to become more and more interested in getting on with this in all sorts of ways. And a number of those ways are already becoming apparent over the time that I was ambassador and since, despite all the headlines about how unhelpful Russia was being over the Iranian nuclear issue. In fact, at the end of the day, they have always gone along. They have very real economic interests in Iran, which they have to some extent placed at stake. They have been reasonably helpful on the Security Council and in establishing sanctions. They have been cooperative in our efforts to deal with Iran. They have good national reasons for doing it. They don't want the Iranians to acquire a bomb any more than we do. But nevertheless, that is a very clear example of Western Russian cooperation, invisible but important. A rather more important one, and equally invisible, is over Afghanistan. Russia has had its own bad experiences in Afghanistan, doesn't like the idea of NATO winning a war anywhere, really, but as the Afghanistan operation has proceeded, have become more and more conscious of the very damaging implications for themselves if NATO loses. One of their great fears, I mean, if I had to identify two big security fears in the Russian mind, one is, as I say, the rising China, and the other is Islamic fundamentalism. That was part of Chechnya, it's part of problems in Tatarstan, it's part of problems in the North Caucasus. And they are very, very keen to limit that. They take quite vigorous action, intelligence and others, in their old empire in Central Asia. And Afghanistan is a real worry for them if the Taliban prevail there. And so they have gradually become much more cooperative in assisting even the dreaded NATO in its operations in Afghanistan. There are now two major transport corridors across Russia, one by rail for non-lethal items and one by plane for lethal items, deliberately intended to assist, in particular, the US war effort in Afghanistan. So, to finish, I can't finish, sadly, on a totally optimistic note. There are reasons why they might revert into the old lazy resource dependency, corrupt Russia, in which case they're going to be left behind by their fellow BRICS and are going to see China as more and more of a looming threat. Or the nation's internal strengths, its dynamism, its consciousness of its own interests vis-à-vis China, vis-à-vis the West, vis-à-vis economic strength will prevail. And we will be dealing 10, 20 years' time, possibly not yet with a democratic Russia, but with a Russia which, with a decent economy, is moving as Korea did, as you know, lots of countries have done, in a democratic direction for the good Marxist reason that once you've got a decent middle class, you then tend to get democracy after it. I err on the optimistic side, hence, as I say, my original title, but I leave you with the question as to which way we're going to go. Thank you very much.